accidents, really, which seem to be how many of the best things in life come along. I had an editor who'd been asking me first to write a dog book, and I said, I don't think I have enough to say about dogs, which is why I did the anthology Dog Culture, because I asked, you know, 11 other people to write with me.
Mm-hmm.
While I was working on getting that book out, I suddenly found myself finding dogs everywhere I went. And I kept referring to them every time we were talking about, you know, the book coming out or publicity or whatever. I would have a dog in the other room that wasn't my dog. And finally the editor said, do you want to write a book about rescuing dogs? And still I thought, you know, I don't think that's very interesting. But the more I talked to other people, the more I realized everyone around me was bewildered by the fact that I constantly was finding these dogs. And I realized apparently nobody else does this. Obviously, there are many other people who do it, but for the most part, people around us don't notice dogs, don't stop and take them in if they see them. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something I can write about there. And what I really wanted to try to do, even though I didn't know what would come of it, was to try to figure out, you know, why do I do this? Not just to tell the stories of many of the dogs that I found, which I do in the book, including sort of figuring out what may have happened to them before I got there, but also sort of exploring the idea of what motivates me to stop, you know, to stop in my tracks, to not worry about being late for a meeting or a vacation or whatever, and to do something for a dog.
Interesting. So you were pursued to write this book as opposed to having to go the usual route, which is a book proposal.
Yeah, agent. Although, you know, the other part of the story is that then I started writing it and several things happened that completely changed the progress of the book and the way the book came together. One was that my hard drive crashed and I didn't back anything up. So everything that I had been working on disappeared. And what I'd been working on really was a series of essays where each essay told the story of a dog but also sort of addressed some other sort of question about the world around us in a way. And so I lost all that, and then as I was gearing up to write again, my heart stopped working, and I had to get a pacemaker. And the fact was that I, for 2 months, was really exhausted, and my dogs knew something was going on, but I refused to acknowledge something was wrong, and it turned out that half my heart hadn't been working for months.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so my pulse was about between 30 and 35 when I was awake, and when I was sleeping, it was going even lower. So, I mean, I came, you know, obviously really close to dying, which completely changed the way I thought about probably everything, but also the whole idea of rescue became much more significant in addressing the subject of this book. You know, it wasn't just about rescuing dogs anymore. It was about the whole idea of, you know, the vulnerability of either trying to save something, because it, you know, when you try to save the life even of a dog, you're revealing that you care about things. And yet, having done many rescues of dogs, to find myself in a situation where I needed to accept help, it was this total reversal that was alien to me. You know, I'd never even been in a hospital overnight to that point. So suddenly the book became much more personal to me. And then at that point I started writing it sort of feverishly and very, very quickly for the first draft, which I think, you know, a lot of people have told me that it reads almost like a diary in the fact that you're sort of so close to what's going on emotionally in my head, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think because I was writing it so urgently, I didn't censor myself, which is always the best way to write, I think.
Yeah, it has a wonderful, wonderful tone. I was taken with it from the start. Your first line, dogs are like tattoos.
And I know, which I, you know, I stole that sort of from Joni Mitchell. I mean, I altered it completely, but I went through this period where I would listen to music and turn every song into a song about dogs. And so I'm listening to Blue by Joni Mitchell, and there's a line, songs are like tattoos, and I just thought dogs are like tattoos.
Interesting.
And later, when I was starting to write the introduction, I was like, dogs are like tattoos.
Uh-huh. Was that always your first line?
What was that?
Was that always the first line?
You know, it wasn't. It wasn't. But when I came to sort of writing what is sort of the introductory chapter, I thought, that's the first line.
Mm-hmm. Well, read to us. It'd be great to hear some of this.
Okay. I can read. I'll read actually beginning at that point.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Ken Foster, author of The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind. Ken.
Dogs are like tattoos. Ask folks about their tattoos, and they can tell you exactly what they were doing, what was going on in their lives when they got them, how the idea came to them, why it seemed at the time a good thing to do. Even if they had lightning bolts tattooed down their face, to hear them talk about it, you realize tattoos are sentimental art. They mark their owners permanently with a visual memorial of the past, like dogs do. I've never had a tattoo, but I've had many dogs, and all of them have left their own indelible marks on me. I found dogs tied under park benches, stuck in drainage grates, running door to door in the neighborhood with half an eye out. I've even had a dog delivered to me by police escort when her owners were involved in a domestic dispute. I've had dogs listed online and placed listings for other dogs to find a home of their own, the dog equivalent of internet dating. I've delayed vacations by stopping to pick up a stray dog on the road. My friends think I must go looking for them. Didn't you just find one last week? Do people bring them to your house? I tell my friends they don't let themselves see them, because then they would have to do something too. People ignore stray dogs the same way they ignore stray people, the way your friends in the city insist that they have never seen any homeless people, or when pressed offer the opinion that these people choose to be on the street and wouldn't want a home of their own if they had one. I was driving down a Mississippi road with Case, one of my blind-to-dog friends, and spotted a dog on the horizon, wandering down the middle of the road, coming towards us as we sped along in my friend's truck. I let out a sigh. "What?" Case asked. He may not see dogs, but you can't sigh around him without explaining yourself. I nodded in the direction of the dog. Case, who was driving, still didn't see anything. "The dog," I said. We were speeding ever closer, and the dog was still coming toward us. A badly matched game of chicken. "What dog?" "Right there," I yelled, pointing at the windshield. "Oh, him," Case said. "He's always there." They find me. It isn't ever the other way around. I don't go marching into overgrown patches looking for dogs who don't even know that they are lost. I don't carry a net in my car that I can toss great distances. What happens instead is this. They come up to me and sit at my feet. They tap me with a paw. They loiter in my path waiting for someone to do something. They can't talk. They can't make signs. There's a limit to how much they can tell us. We are supposedly more smarter than they are, but clearly not more intuitive. If we had their skills for assessing a situation, I would never see this. Car after car, swerving to avoid two dachshunds wandering the middle of a highway, most not even slowing down. Rescuing something takes time, and there is a risk of revealing something about yourself, your vulnerability, that isn't fashionable at all. That's what people don't understand. You do it because it is difficult. You do it because you aren't sure of things. You do it without knowing how any of it will turn out, or how much of it will cost you, or if the story will be happy or tragic in the end.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful first chapter. That was Ken Foster reading from The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind. What a distinct voice, and it's such a compelling voice. Did you have this from the start?
Is from the start of writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, is it simply your from the start of your life? No. have you always had this with this project, or is it just, is it your writing voice?
You know, I think my voice has changed. I mean, I studied with a number of great, great teachers, and I always tell people who are studying writing to study with a number of people, because you can learn different things from different people, and then you pull them together in your own way. But a number of the people I've worked with have always been about sort of boiling things down to your voice, or to, you know, to a sense of the personal, and to a degree, you know, what used to be called minimalism, although I hate that term. But I think with this book, one of the things I've sort of realized, I had no idea when I was writing it, but just in the reception it's received and in going back and looking at it, something about it was so urgent in the writing that it became very, very honest and very direct, and I didn't censor anything. And I think early on I was worried about being sentimental and about revealing that I have feelings that might be corny or whatever. And yet at a certain point I thought, who cares? You know, just go ahead. Go, just be honest, and that's all that matters. And so I think that's, you know, the base of where the voice comes from. But I've also always thought that, you know, that writing should sound good, that it should always be conveying something important, that every word should count, but that at the same time you don't want it to be monotonous, and you want to sort of find the most interesting way of saying things and have sentences that are different and all that stuff too, you know?
Mm.
But I think with this book, it's so much about just saying what I want to say and not really caring about its reception, mm-hmm. in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want people to receive it exactly as I'm saying it, but I'm not trying to manipulate it, really, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense, because what comes through in the writing is sincerity and honesty, and it's direct. So if it's, you know, weepy in parts, it's because that's what's happening. It's not because you've contrived to make the reader feel something. It's just there.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, the past couple of years, as anyone who reads the book knows, there have been so many sort of over-the-top life-and-death situations in my life that I think even with the fiction that I've been working on lately, there's a certain degree which everything I'm writing, it's all about life and death. You know, like every page is about life and death in some way, which my previous work sort of wasn't. And I'm not sure if I can articulate it in any other way than that. But
mm-hmm.
But when I sort of look at everything I'm working on, there's this sense of urgency and this sense that in some place in everything I'm working on, even in short stories, there's a question of saving a life in some way.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's all here. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Ken Foster, author of The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind, published by the Lions Press. And you can visit his website, dogswhofoundme.com, to read more about him and about the book and all sorts of things. You have some wonderful blurbs on your book. Wonderful blurbs, which is so impressive, because even without opening the book, you know that it's going to be a wonderful work of narrative nonfiction. I mean, I love what Roxana Robinson says. I read this at once and could hardly bear to put it down. It delivers something crucial about bravery, the human spirit, and the place that dogs occupy in our landscapes. It's about confronting need, vulnerability, and love, and responding. What a nice, wonderful, wonderful blurb.
I know. I've sort of been blown away by the reception the book has had from both people who gave quotes very generously ahead of time and some of the reviews afterwards that have said, you know, like, it's a book about love and survival and things like that. And it's obviously, it's a dog book, but it's also something more than that, and I'm so grateful that people have recognized that as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when I was sending out the book for quotes, I sent it to a variety of people that I thought might respond for different reasons, but I didn't really know that they would respond or what their response would be. And so, you know, some of the quotes I got back, I was so amazed by, because there was no obligation on these people to give me any quote, you know?
Right, right. It's just...
And, you know, sometimes you do go for those quotes as well, but in this case, I just asked a variety of people, none of whom I thought were guaranteed to say anything at all, and they all came with something great and something also very different.
Mm-hmm. They sure did. Did you have any surprises, experience any surprises along the way writing this book? Or did it pretty much go the way you thought it was going to go?
Well, you know, first of all, I didn't know that it was going to be about my almost dying, because I hadn't almost died when I first conceived of writing the book. But also, the whole Hurricane Katrina thing actually wasn't part of the book. I thought I'd finished the book before all this happened, and I very carefully crafted what I thought was the final chapter, which I realized when you're writing a memoir that really is a true memoir and just a section of your life, you have to figure out, so where's the end?
Mm-hmm.
The end isn't the end of your life. And so after my pacemaker episode, I rescue this Rottweiler who's going to be put to sleep because he has a heart problem as well. And I take him back and give him to somebody who gave me one of my first dogs in Florida. And I thought, like, well, that's the perfect ending because everything's happy, everything's resolved. And that's what the ending was until Hurricane Katrina came along. And so I felt sort of compelled, partially because I was in evacuation mode and living in limbo and I had nothing to do, but also because the book begins with September 11th and how September 11th sort of shaped my relationship with my first dog. And it seemed too bizarre and yet too weirdly perfect to have this horrible, horrible bookend of Katrina at the end. And there's also a dog in the middle of the book named Katrina, which made it even more bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that itself was completely unexpected. But also when I finally finished writing the book, I sort of realized with a degree of horror, I have to say, that it was really a book about being vulnerable, you know, emotionally and in many other ways. Because at the end of the book, you know, first I have this heart problem where I am, you know, rushed to the emergency room and put in surgery and given a mechanical device that will keep me alive. And then after that, it's Hurricane Katrina, where I end up going from city to city with nothing but me and my dogs looking, you know, for people to take us in. And the amazing thing was that I had many, many people willing to take us in. But still, it was, you know, I was sort of like being stripped down to the basics of my identity, which in my case are me and my three dogs, you know. And when I finished, I kind of thought, oh, my God, what have I done? Because, you know, this is me sort of laying here on the page, and I don't have any idea how people are going to respond to it.
Yeah.
Because it is so personal, that's what people are responding to.
Mm-hmm.
As personal as it is to me, people are finding things in it that ring true for them as well.
How are people responding? Do you get emails and hear from readers?
I've been getting so many emails, and a lot of them are from pit bull owners because two of my dogs are pit bulls, and I love pit bulls. I speak on their behalf, and I worry about the way they're stereotyped and the fact that people choose to blame these dogs instead of their irresponsible owners in certain cases. And so many people have written to me and come to my readings because they are responsible owners of pit bulls who are members of their family and who sleep in their bed with them, and they've never had the chance to read a story that is about essentially them and their dog, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You only see a pit bull in the paper when it does something wrong.
Yes.
And so people constantly are emailing me, thanking me for writing a book that talks about this positive relationship with a pit bull dog. So that's one of the responses people are having. And also the urge to rescue dogs. So many people that rescue dogs haven't really, I think, you know, seen their story told in some way. And also a lot of people who aren't part of the, you know, sort of animal world at all, but who for one reason or another have read it and been fascinated to sort of peek into this kind of existence of living with dogs and rescuing dogs and all of the rest of it. So it seems to have, you know, struck many different chords, which is kind of, you know, I'm still getting used to the idea that I'm getting this kind of response in the book.
Oh, how about the cover? Do you know the dog on the cover?
That's my dog, Sula.
Oh, is that your dog?
Yeah, it's my dog, Sula. She's a pit bull who I think I've rescued twice. I found a litter of pit bulls wandering my street when I lived in Florida and returned them to their owners, who were clearly not people that should be breeding pit bulls. And a year, almost exactly a year later, a year-old pit bull showed up in the neighborhood again. And she'd been lurking in the neighborhood and wouldn't come near anybody until I came out and called her. And she came running over and has been with me ever since.
Oh, what a wonderful book. And we're at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening.
Writers? I mean, the main advice I have is to keep writing. People used to always tell me, if you keep writing, eventually you're going to succeed and you will be published. And I thought they were, you know, crazy. It's like, that's not going to happen. But the truth is, the more you write, the more you understand what it is you're trying to do and the more you understand what you aren't doing right. And also to read other people's work and to use reading other people's work as a practice for developing a critical eye you can bring back on your own work. I think that's crucial, and I think that's what workshops are good for, is sort of training yourself rather than getting feedback on your work, even though that's part of a workshop. It's really more about training your own eye by reading everyone else's work in the workshop, and then taking that back to yourself and pretending that you've never seen your own work before and writing the same kind of skeptical questions you've been writing on everyone else's papers, you know?
Really good points. Yeah, and just thanks so much for coming on, and continued good luck with The Dogs Who Found Me.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
It was Ken Foster, author of The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind, published by the Lions Press. And again, his website is dogswhofoundme.com. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have Leora Krieger with us. What else can I tell you? It will be on till 6 o'clock. We're here every Thursday, 5 p.m. Pacific time on KUCI.org, 88.9. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
You know, folks, I've written so many songs, it's kind of hard to keep track of all of them. But here's one the folks seem to like, and I like it too. Here's the way it goes.
Join me, Wanda, for Howdylicious, the best in Western swing, rockabilly, classic country, and alternative twangy music, every Sunday night from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., only on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.